and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2060. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on what the bill is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. House Bill 2060 would authorize community college districts to offer alternative retirement programs in addition to the public employee retirement system to their employees. Would allow each district board to specify the classes of employees that would be eligible for participation in the alternative program if one is offered. And it would disallow a person participating in an alternative plan from being an active member of PERS. Mr. Chair, as you can see, the bill is pretty short and is similar in language to what was allowed for the Oregon Health Sciences University in 1995 when Oregon Health Sciences became a public corporation, was made a public corporation by the legislature. Mr. Chair, we do not have a fiscal impact statement as yet for the bill, but there may be some discussion of that from the representatives. Thank you. And we have one person joining us by phone, so I'd like to...
Go ahead and get us hooked up. Is that the individual? Could I have...
Hello, Fred Smith.
Hi, Mr. Smith. This is Janet Adkins, and you're on the air. We're just now calling Lori Satinspiel and Dan Timberlake up, and I think Lori's going to start.
And Joe
so
Bauman.
Yeah.
Mr. Smith, can you hear us? This is Representative Alan Brown.
Yes, sir. I can hear you just fine, sir.
Okay. Thank you for being here this morning.
Well, thank you for allowing me to do this, sir.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
I feel like that commercial. Yeah, I still can.
Okay. Thank you. I don't know what order we want to start in here, Lori. I guess Lori's going to start for us.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee. I'm Lori Satinspiel from the Oregon Community College Association, Government Relations. We represent all 17 of Oregon's community colleges. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2060. We worked with Representative Butler to have the bill drafted and appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. The purpose of the bill is to give community college districts the ability to offer their employees a choice of retirement options in addition to PERS. More and more recruiting faculty and staff from outside the state, and many already have existing retirement plans and aren't interested in participating in the state pension plan. This bill would give them another option. This is the same option that current Oregon University System and Oregon Health Sciences University employees have. The portability of these plans is a huge incentive to the mobile workforce. You'll hear testimony today from fellow panelists about having this option would make it easier to recruit and retain employees. I want to take just a minute to address why the bill is drafted so broadly. We modeled the bill after OHSU's statutory language that passed in 1995 to give local control to community colleges and the flexibility to design the parameters of the optional retirement plan to meet the needs of their employees. Under this legislation, no community college would be required to offer the optional retirement plan, and no employee would be required to participate. How the plans would be structured and who could participate would be developed in the future by the colleges based on the needs of their employees and how they, if they choose to offer the plan. This is not an attempt to undermine PERS. The majority of the community colleges, probably the employees would remain in PERS. Rather, it be the community college another recruiting tool, an option that might be attractive to someone who doesn't intend to stay in the same school or in the state system for their entire career. It would allow employees to choose a retirement plan that best works for them and their families. Thank you for your consideration, and with that, I'd like to move to Fred Smith, President of Klamath Community College, who's joined us by phone.
Mr. Smith?
Chairman Brown.
Thank you. We're ready for your testimony.
Certainly. I'd like to substantiate some of the things that Lori has spoken to you about this morning. That's why we're in support of House Bill 2060 as well. Community college personnel, professionals, are very highly mobile individuals, and they change their jobs quite often during their careers, and they move from state to state pretty freely. Therefore, a lot of systems have this kind of a personal retirement plan, and we support the ability to do that ourselves. So let me give you a couple of actual things that have occurred at my campus, okay? I am the president of the community college, and I'm the president of the community college because the previous president had almost 30 years in his own individual plan. And then when he came to the state of Oregon, he did not have the ability to add to his plan, and so he had to join PERS. Therefore, when all the changes in PERS happened during the last legislative session, basically he had to leave because he had a great deal of money that he would have lost if he hadn't. If he could have had the opportunity and the option, he would probably still be here and he would be speaking to you today, telling you that it's a good thing to have. But another example of my institution is I have a woman who teaches for me, and she has 7 years of paid experience into her personal retirement system from the state of New York. Now, she's worked for me for 7 years and has 7 years in the PERS system. It would be much better for her to have one large lump sum in a large program than two small ones. It makes more sense for her to be able to have us continue to contribute to that. How we would do it would be either a negotiation through a contract or through an individual negotiation, but we think that this would be a really, really good system for us as we go to recruit faculty members from around the nation. And so we urge your support for 2060, and would take any questions if you have any, but we are certainly in support of HB 2060. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I think that we will hear from the entire panel, and then we will open it up for questions. Go ahead, sir.
And I'm Dan Timberlake. I'm a current employee at Lane Community College. I'm the director of the counseling department there. And initially, after my graduate training at the University of Missouri, I took a job. The first job I had with retirement benefits was at the University of Utah, where I was for 6 years. Then I took a job as the associate director of the counseling department at OSU. And at that point, I knew I wanted to move on, so when I evaluated the job at OSU, I looked to make sure that they had an optional retirement plan. They called it an ORP. And they did, and I was in TIAA CREF at Utah. And then when I came to Oregon State, I had the option to stay in TIAA CREF, which I had a good experience with at Utah. So it didn't feel like a big risk or venturing into kind of unknown waters when I went there. But when I was ready to be a director of a counseling department, I was interested in the position posting at Lane Community College, but it was 2002, and I was a little concerned because there was a lot of news in the papers about PERS, and things were looking kind of bleak at that point. So I chose not to apply, in part because of the limited retirement options. I would have to leave a privately managed retirement plan. I had two kids and a wife that I had to think about. And I wasn't sure about the portability if I wanted to, let's say, after I was director of the counseling department, the next step is an associate vice president position at some other school, let's say. And I wasn't sure that I would financially be able to leave Lane, given the lack of portability. In my case, they didn't get enough applications in the pool, and they reopened the search. And my friends from Lane called me and said, well, come on, you know, everything's going to work out okay. You really should apply. So I did reapply. The search was reopened. Oftentimes, however, I think applicants choose not to apply, and in their case, the search isn't reopened, and they don't have friends at the institution who call them and say, no, listen, this is really going to work out okay, and come on down here. And so I guess I'm trying to put a face on an applicant who would look at this, the retirement plans at the community colleges, and have it influence a decision as to where to go. When you are moving from, let's say, Utah, and you hear about PERS, you've never heard of PERS. You don't know what PERS is. You know what TIFCREF is. You know what Vanguard is. You know other plans you've heard about, and you know their background, their reputation. Typically, you don't have a lot of time to research what each state's public employee retirement system is when you come in, and you don't really know what's going on, but you hear it's not portable, and you're not sure you want to stay there. So it makes a difference. It made a difference for me when I originally decided not to apply. And I think it probably has made a difference for a lot of other applicants as well.
Okay, Joe, please.
Good morning, Chairman Brown, rest of the committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Joe Bauman, and I'm with TIFCREF. I'm director of our Seattle office, which handles institutions in Idaho, Alaska, Washington, and Oregon. And my purpose today is to explain the role that TIFCREF has played over the years in the optional retirement plan established for the Oregon University System, as well as the plan adopted by Oregon Health Science University. In the Oregon University System, the optional retirement plan is only available to faculty and administrators. At OHSU, it's actually available to all employees, so they make the employees at OHSU are eligible for PERS and the optional retirement plan, whereas OUS limits it to professors and administrators. Oregon, like most other states, offers university professors and administrators an opportunity to select PERS or the ORP, and these optional retirement plans are now offered in 48 states. And in 41 of the 48 states, the community colleges are also offering the optional retirement plan. So it's really out there. The company I represent, TIFCREF, is a nonprofit company and the nation's leading pension system serving the retirement and financial needs of educators, public and nonprofit sector employees, and to a small degree the general public. We have $350 billion under management. We have the highest ratings from AM Best, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. And we currently serve over 2.9 million participants in over 15,000 public sector, private, and nonprofit institutions. Our company is unique. We were originally founded in 1918 with a grant from the Andrew Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, and the original mission of TIFCREF was to establish a portable pension system to encourage private sector professionals to enter the teaching profession. Carnegie found it incomprehensible that there was no pension system for educators, and so that's how the firm started. We've been actively engaged in providing private pension services throughout the country, including Oregon, for the past several decades. Since 1967, TIFCREF has provided retirement benefits to Oregon public employees on campuses of Oregon University System and OHSU, including all private sector and public sector. This type of pension today provides benefits to more than 16,725 Oregon participants at more than 100 institutions. Our plans are offered at all private institutions in the state of Oregon as well, K-12 as well as the private universities such as Willamette University nearby. The ORP and UPP have proven to be a success for the employer universities, for the eligible employees, and for the Oregon PERS and taxpayers. Approximately 30% of new hires have selected these defined contribution plans during the last several years. So many people are continuing to enroll in PERS, but 30% are going into the optional retirement plans based on the most recent couple of years statistics we've gotten from the employers. In comparison to Oregon PERS, or the new Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, participation in an alternate retirement program would offer Oregon Community College employees the following four advantages. Number one, portability of all benefits accumulated during employment. Number two, an opportunity to develop a flexible investment portfolio that meets their specific individual needs. Number three, access to investment and retirement planning education offered by world-class financial organizations in person, on the phone, or via the internet. And then finally, I think a key one, ability to set one's own retirement age without the penalty of actuarial reductions that occur in a defined benefit plan if normal retirement age and other conditions are not obtained. I urge the committee to support HB 2060 to allow Oregon's community college employees the option of adopting an alternate retirement program. Thank you.
Thank you. This plan in no way is extended to classified employees. Is that right?
Chairman Brown, that's why it was drafted broadly for each local community college to make that distinction. It's not stated in this bill.
Okay, so it's conceivable or possible that any employee at a community college could opt into this plan.
Chair Brown, you're correct. Based on the college's decision.
Depending on what the.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any statistics or knowledge as to how often people in community colleges move, and how, in comparison then to, say, teachers in the K through 12 system, is there, are one more the professional staff at a community college more mobile than people in the K through 12 system?
I don't really have any statistics on that. No.
And Chair Brown, I don't know that we keep those. I could do some research.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any idea how many people would opt into this if it was available to community colleges then?
Chairman Brown, no, I don't. I suspect we're really looking at the new people coming in, but giving the current ones an option. From OHSU and OUS, I understand it was a small percentage.
The university system plan, that are classified employees eligible to participate in?
No, they're not.
The option. They're
no,
not.
Chairman Brown, they're not.
They
no,
are
the,
precluded there.
They are precluded, right. So just faculty and certain level administrators at any of the OUS institutions, they're the only ones eligible for the optional retirement plan.
Okay, and so this plan does not mirror in entirety then the university plan?
Chair Brown, no.
Okay. Any other representative, Sean?
Thank you. And why doesn't it? If we're worried about people that are mobile, why are we not just sticking just to those folks like we did in the university plan? Why are we allowing everybody in? Explain that to me. Like, for example, a janitor is not going to be mobile. They're going to be staying in the same community. Why aren't we just narrowing it down to those folks that do, for very good reasons, are mobile? Mm-hmm.
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, we're leaving that locally to each community college. I'm assuming they will narrow that down based on what they decide to do. It isn't written. It could be written in. We wanted to do this on purpose, is to leave it open so that each college could make their own decisions with their locally elected board.
Thank you.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you, Ms. Sharon. Lori, I guess this question is to you. Are you viewing this more as a recruitment tool to help, as a benefit for teachers across the country to come to Oregon and saying this is an option, you're not stuck in, or stuck is probably not the right word to use for PERS, but you have more than one option, you have portability, you have the transferability of your insurance, please come to Oregon, great state, great place to teach. Is it a recruitment tool then?
Chairman Brown, Representative Kitts, yes, and Dan alluded to that as well in his testimony. Yes, for recruitment is our main purpose.
Thank you.
And may I add a comment?
Love to hear it.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts. Yeah, I think that's exactly the thing. And when you look at the situation now that anybody coming into a community college would enroll in the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, which is a fine plan, a result of a lot of things that took place several years ago. But if they're a mid-career person that has accumulated, say, 15 years worth of accumulation at TI Cref and their private fund, and they're 45 or 50 years old, and their game plan is to retire at 60, which would be after, say, 30 or 35 years of education, then the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, because of the benefit formula, doesn't look quite as attractive as it might be if they could continue to build up their own accumulation and hit their own target retirement age. So, definitely from a recruiting standpoint, having an alternative, allowing people to look at an opportunity at a community college in Oregon, which is a great place to live, but you don't want great people to be turning down a position because financially they simply can't make it work for them. And retirement for somebody who spent 20 years of work already is a big factor in their decision.
Sure. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffler.
Are we recruiting all around the country for classified employees? I told Ms. Satinspiel yesterday I had some problems with this. If we're recruiting for educators, professors, folks like that, fine. I really have no problem with that. I understand the mobility in those career choices. But you know what? Then let's limit it to that. If that's what this is all about, I have no problem with that. We did it with the university system, and I got no problem with that. But it's more than that, and that's my problem right there. I just think, you know, if we're going to use it, if we're going to do this to recruit around the country for the best educators we can find, fine. Then let's just do that. But expanding it to everybody, well, I think there's some issues there.
Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got some concerns, I guess, you know, about, you know, we've struggled with PERS and, you know, the market's come back, it's become more financially sound, and I really worry with all these alternate retirement programs that may be unintended, but we do undermine the PERS program. I know you've stated that it's not intended to undermine PERS, but... You know, in the OUS system, the alternative retirement plans employer contribution rates are tied to PERS, and in this plan they are not. And that kind of raises a flag for me that this potentially could undermine the program, especially opening it up to, I guess this is a voluntary program, to anybody that wants to get into it. So, you know, that piece of it really bothers me a little bit, because I think long term, looking at it, you know, the stability of PERS sort of comes into questions as this kind of program might proliferate. Can you comment on why this program isn't, the contribution rates aren't tied to the PERS contribution rates?
Chair Brown, Representative Holby, OUS is tied to PERS. OHSU gives a flat 6%. We haven't structured the plan yet because we want the local colleges to do that. We can do that if that would make this feel better for everyone. We could tie it to a certain rate. We didn't want to tie the hands of our locally elected board members.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons that I'm saying, and I think we're missing a little bit of the picture here, is it's not just teachers that you're trying to recruit from a national level. You get people at all different levels within the community college system that you're recruiting from across the country. It's not just janitors. It could be administrators of various programs, administrators of athletic programs, coaches, and these sorts of classified staff. So I applaud you for bringing forward a bill that would support choice in a system that so badly needs it. And I think that it says a lot that the PERS board is neutral to this. So, thank you again.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for testifying. Thank you, Mr. Smith, for testifying today and being part of the process here. Do you want to stay connected and hear the rest of the testimony?
Actually, if it's not going to be on 2060, then I will go, sir.
We've got several other people lined up here to testify on 2060.
I would love to listen, sir.
Okay.
Brad, you just missed your opportunity to bail.
Representative Kitt said that he'll leave in your place.
Tie me down.
Could I have Rob Wagner and Beth Ann Darby, please?
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. My name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm with the Oregon Education Association. And today I'm here with Rob Wagner to talk about the impact of this bill on PERS members, specifically our community college faculty. This bill, it differs from the language that OHSU uses in a number of respects. First of all, OHSU is a public corporation, which this community, which OCCA and the community college districts are not. They have separate statutes around this issue for that particular purpose. So our first concern is that this may not be the best place to make the change. The second piece is that in Section 2, the last sentence of the new language is brand new. It would take the power away from employees to have a say in their retirement plan and put it completely with the employer. That is something new and different that neither the optional retirement plan or OHSU take advantage of. So that would be something different. And if we really are, if it is a good idea to pursue an alternative retirement plan, then the language in ORS 243-800 seems to us to be a better choice because it allows employees and individuals to evaluate which plans make the best sense for them. And that would mirror what is already happening in higher education at the other universities. So, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague here to talk about the plan.
As I say, good morning. For the record, Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers. Our members include faculty at some of our university systems and faculty and classified employees at some of our community colleges. So I will say that we are sort of a tepid no on this right now because our faculty at the university system have had very positive experiences with the TIAA-CREF plan and really do enjoy the portability. But I believe also they enjoy the safeguards of the language that is in 243-800, which is the optional retirement plan, versus what OHSU offers to their employees. I can't speak too much to what the OHSU plan is. We do like the language in this legislation, the fact that it is permissive, so that it would be an option to employees at our community colleges to opt into to a plan that is provided. However, in turning to the optional retirement plan, there are certain safeguards that are in that legislation that we really like. There's a one-time irrevocable election, so that if a faculty member comes in, they can make a one-time choice at that point to choose the optional retirement plan versus coming into PERS. And talking with somebody from OHSU yesterday afternoon, I understand that every year there's actually an option which creates some, a lot of variability. I think Steve Delaney is here from PERS and might be able to talk about what the impacts are on the PERS system with having people that have can come in and out a little bit more. And then finally, in terms of the language of the House Bill 2060 and the fact that it's so broad, the piece that was talked about in terms of it being a recruitment tool, with the rate being set by the employer, we'd sort of have some questions. Right now in 243-800, there is that security that the rate is linked to the PERS employer rate, which we appreciate. And then also it was brought up about the number of members who are in the optional retirement plan, how I think it was stated there was just a few people. Our experience with our faculty are that more and more people, I think actually a majority at our campuses, at least the Eastern and Western Oregon University, of new faculty are actually choosing the optional retirement plan right now as they come in. So it might be interesting to get PERS's take too on the actual number of people that are in the ORP. So with that, and I will say we'd be glad to work with the sponsors of this language to see if we can alleviate some of our concerns and see if we can make a really good bill here.
So the university system plan, then the professional staff can be in. They can choose to be in PERS or into the optional plan, or they.
I believe it's faculty and administrators.
Only, but they can be either or, huh?
Yeah, they can be either or, and you get what happened, I believe, is when the legislation passed in 95, faculty were given an option to come into the ORP. And see, if Steve Delaney's nodding, then I know that I'm on track here.
Okay.
They were given an option, and then when new faculty come in, they have an option at that point to either choose the ORP, the TIAA-CREF plan, or the or PERS. And it's a one-time irrevocable election, which provides a lot of stability for PERS in determining what employer rates are going to be and those sorts of things.
Chair Brown, if I also might add, in the last legislative session, we created the new Oregon Public Service Retirement Program. And part of the purpose of the new retirement program, we put an end to PERS and Tier 1 and Tier 2 status, and we created this new plan. And part of the purpose was the issue of portability. It does have a defined benefit and a defined contribution component. And so I would just point out that we have a retirement system in place currently for new employees, both classified and faculty and administrators, that does allow for some portability on the 6% employee contribution component.
Thank you. Any questions?
I have one.
Representative Escobar.
Yeah, Ms. Darby, I'm kind of curious here. You said you're not for the change. You're coming out against it. But yet what I see here is optional. Very key word here. The other thing I see is, why wouldn't you want people to have more choice?
Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, I think that my position on this bill is very similar to Mr. Wagner's, and that is that we're just not sure about the language in this particular bill. We feel more comfortable with the language that the rest of the university system uses. The language that is in this particular statute was geared towards OHSU's specific needs as a public corporation and not as a public entity. And so I think our concerns are with the language in this bill. We also have concerns about portability, and we are willing to work with the sponsors of the bill to alleviate some of our concerns and give our members that option.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying today. We have with us Representative Butler. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. You've heard testimony pro and con this morning relative to House Bill 2060. I bring you to House Bill 2060 on behalf of the requests of my local community college, who would like to have the same opportunity to attract professors and professional staff from out of state, folks who are, in effect, transitioning their career opportunities through our community colleges into the Oregon University system and other university systems, who have opportunities to already afford themselves of the opportunity to have alternate retirement tools as an opportunity to go ahead and transition through the process of moving around. These jobs typically, and more so in the community college system even than within the Oregon University system and the higher education system, are somewhat transitory. Typically, a very, very excellent teacher will be moving through the system and will move around several times during their professional lives, and it's hoped that they would eventually take their doctorate and teaching degrees to the university, to the upper level university level, where these opportunities of alternative retirement programs are already available to them. So this is very important for the caliber and the quality of the teaching staff, which we're able to procure on our small community college campuses. It gives us an opportunity to have an attractive tool, an additional recruiting tool, if you will, to bring professors of the caliber that we feel like that we can attract, that would like to continue to contribute to those alternative retirement systems that are available to them in most other states, and which are available to them in the higher education system, as I've said, in the state of Oregon. With that, as I say, you've heard testimony both pro and con this morning, and I just wanted you to know that this is very important for those of us who reside in districts that are very dependent upon our community college system.
Thank you, Representative, and I applaud you for introducing this bill on behalf of community colleges, and I agree that it's a very important step to help our community college and the professional people within the community college.
Sure.
Would be a broader plan than what's at the university systems. Would you be receptive to an amendment that would narrow it down so it would be more closely mirror what's at university systems?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, certainly that's the attempt would be to make certain that these folks, these professors, the professional teaching staff, that we're able to attract, while they may not be able to move their plans portably to other states, which would engender the broader language, if we could get the language so that it would mirror that of the Oregon University system, I would be amenable to that kind of an amendment, and that would certainly be very acceptable, because that's the next logical place. However, we do see this kind of teaching staff, typically when they begin teaching at a community college, we'll see them move to other community colleges within the Oregon University or Oregon College system, or community college and workforce development system, and then typically we'll see them move rather than out of the state of Oregon, or rather than within the state of Oregon to the university system directly, we'll see them move around within the university systems nationally, and then end up back in Oregon. So while that would not give them the maximum flexibility that they may enjoy in other opportunities to teach nationwide, it would certainly give them that opportunity to have a flex plan that would be a good recruiting tool for, and maybe with the limited language, then you've got a more captive group of professors and teachers that the Oregon University system would have a better shot at acquiring too. So while I am anxious about the fact that these folks might end up teaching at two or three of the community college systems before they would go into the university system, I would like to keep them here with the Oregon University system rather than lose them to Idaho or Utah or Montana or another one of the Northwest colleges or university systems.
You live awful close to the Idaho border. Do you think they're pretty good?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's always an issue when we live that close to, when you can set a golf ball out on East Idaho Avenue in Ontario and don't have to be a very good golfer and can hit, can get it over somewhere in one of the holes in Idaho. So it is an issue. We have this issue directly, exactly, and frequently, this issue with the BSU at Boise State, and they're becoming a very major force in our valley, and we do have, recognizing this, our community college folks have worked very closely with BSU to try and do all that they can to make sure that the maximum benefit for the teaching staffs of the two institutions of higher learning are benefited. But this would give us the tool that we would really need to have to benefit all of our community colleges at this time.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. We got education staff going over to Idaho, and they got wolves coming over here.
Representative Chair Brown or Vice Chair Schaffler, we'd like them to share one thing with us, but not the other.
Yes, sir. I'm Chair Brown, more serious now. Thank you for your flexibility. I think the concerns were the broadness of it. And just for the record, I went to community college in a rural town in Iowa where I grew up. And the great staff and educators there motivated me to go on to the university and graduate. And may well be, I can give credit there, and maybe some give blame for me sitting here. But so I thank you for being flexible. I appreciate that. I think it is a good idea that we try and recruit the best we can, especially out in the hinterland, and get every kind of opportunity to kind of get folks out there and to stay there, hopefully, too. So thank you, Representative.
Chair Brown, Vice Chair Schaffler, I thank you very much for that testimony on behalf of the community colleges. I think if we went back to your community college, we'd see this kind of program probably already available on those community college campuses that were able to attract the excellent staff that were obviously there to teach you. So I'm anxious that Oregon bring itself up, particularly in light of the other amendments which were very capably afforded us through the 2003 legislative session with regard to expanding and enhancing our public employee retirement system in the state of Oregon. This would give us yet another arrow in our quiver of the tools that we need to use to be able to attract those same kinds of excellent staff that were at your community college.
Any other questions? representing kids.
Tom, I would concur with you on pretty much everything that you've said, and I like a lot of the language that's currently in the bill without amendments. But I thank you for your willingness to come forward with this, and I think that you speak to the problem more specifically because of your location, because of the example that you just gave as far as the golf ball right into the next state. We've got to do everything that we can possibly do to keep the best teachers here and bring the best teachers here. And I thank you for bringing this bill.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I absolutely concur. And again, it's so very important that we do all that we can to make certain that our students are benefited. Ultimately, the students are benefited through this kind of a process. But at the same time, I do want to be sensitive to our organized employees that have some concern over these kinds of things. This bill was not brought to the committee, to the legislature, in any attempt to try and denigrate their status or to attempt to try and run roughshod over other groups of employees. This is, nor is it in any way an attempt to try and downplay the serious financial condition that the PERS has experienced and is now working itself out of. What it is just an opportunity, just another, as I say, just another arrow in your quiver to allow the Oregon University system to work directly with our community college system to be able to say, yes, there's a place for you in Oregon if you'll bring your excellent teaching, researching, healing arts, those other kinds of skills to our universities. That's what we want to bring here, and that's the additional opportunity that we can afford you through this kind of legislation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, Representative. Could I have Steve Delaney, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of PERS. As has been stated, the PERS board is neutral on this bill. We certainly understand the need for optional opportunities to bring academic employees into Oregon where the PERS plan may not be able to cover their needs. Our concern is the administrative side of things. PERS is a complex plan, and we deal with a lot of complex issues at times. Just to give you some brief background as to the difference between OHSU and OUS and their different plans, in 97, when these two bills were coming through the session, the Oregon University system had a very detailed bill in place, which became 243-800, with very detailed outline to PERS as to how we were to treat members if they chose an alternate plan. OHSU had a very simple one-liner that said they may offer an alternative plan. During that 97 session, OHSU continued to say we're going to follow the university system's plan, and so there wasn't a lot of discussion. The assumption was that OHSU would mirror the university system plan. That isn't what actually happened. When it actually got implemented, their language, the OHSU language, was this very broad statement. You can offer an alternative plan. And that led to quite a number of just administrative detail issues for PERS. The default, if a person didn't elect this optional plan within the first 6 months, which plan did they default to, PERS or the alternate plan? Which employees were impacted? When could these elections be made? It was clear for us on the university system side it hadn't been on the OHSU side. So that's the only concern we wanted to share, is it's helpful to PERS if some kind of direction can be given, especially to certain basic issues, the effective date, who's covered, and especially this issue of default. If someone doesn't make an election, where do they go? It simply makes our job easier in administering. But again, as we say, for neutral, we certainly understand the desire for an optional plan.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? I don't see any. So thank you again, Steve, for your testimony. And committee, my intentions are to form a work group with the Representative Escobar has agreed to chair that work group and get in touch with you, Laurie, and other people that have an interest and put together a solution to this, and then we'll try to move this legislation on it.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2060 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2412. And we have Representative Smith with us here this morning. Janet, can you give us a...
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2412 would require a consumer reporting business or company to stop furnishing reports about a consumer if the consumer so requests, and to furnish reports only to persons or during periods of time designated by that consumer. There's a definition of consumer reporting agency. The bill also requires consumer reporting companies to inform consumers about the rights that are going to be in the bill, and would make violations of the provisions an unlawful trade practice in Oregon. It would give the Department of Consumer and Business Services authority to investigate and enforce the provisions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Good morning. Oh, do we still have some?
Oh, sorry.
Is he still there?
That's Mr. Smith, are you still there?
Mr. Smith? I know a Mr. Smith.
The one on the phone is. Thank you, Patty, for being patient with us this morning, trying to manage our way through the minefield here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and I do have a committee meeting at 9 o'clock, so I handed out my testimony to you. I'm going to try not to read it because that drives me crazy as a chair. But being on this side is a little bit different than being on that side. I'm State Representative Patty Smith, House District 52. I'm here on behalf of House Bill 2412 that Senator Metzger and I have co-sponsored. Representative Ackerman, I believe, has sent you a letter, giving the committee a letter on the Dash 1 amendments that explain the difference between the two. And he is a sponsor on this bill also. And I want to thank Susan Corwin, my constituent, who you're going to hear from next, who has been a victim of identity theft and is the reason why I'm bringing this bill. I provided you with copies of newspaper and internet reports of the latest in identity theft. I think we're all well aware of the increase that we're facing in this state due to identity theft problems. I sit on the governor's meth task force, and I am just amazed how those two are interconnected. People are stealing our personal information and our privacy probably as we speak. The recent Choice Point, the Bank of America scandals, all I've documented in copies I've given you of recent articles and things that we can do. And one of the things that we as Oregonians can do is promote this kind of Consumer Protection Act. It is a credit freeze. That's what this bill does. It allows you to create your credit report where you have the accountability for taking the personal information that is yours and protect it. You have the ability to do that under this bill. I think if there's questions on the way the bill is written, you need to contact legislative counsel and have them come up and explain it to you, because I'm not an attorney and I don't pretend to be. But I know we have a real problem in this state with identity theft. And this allows one option for the consumer. It's a consumer-friendly bill. I think you're going to hear lots of opposition to this bill, because it costs, but it costs, I think what it says in this article, is about $16,000 per person for every time your identity is stolen. And we need better access, more things that we can do as consumers to protect our credit. Mr. Chairman, I know your name is Brown and my name is Smith.
That's fishy.
It makes me very nervous. Every time I think about this, I guess in my letter I say that if the federal legislation had worked, we wouldn't be in this predicament that we're in. And we as Oregon lawmakers have policy decisions to make, and therefore we're bringing this bill. So I guess, because of the time constraints, I'll let you have, if you have any questions for me, or I'm sure you're going to hear from Susan Corwin and many others on this important bill. But this is an important consumer bill for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Any questions? I don't see anything. We'll let you go to your meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thank you for allowing the testimony to be heard on this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before Representative, I apologize. I've got this thing in my
throat. Too late.
Get out of here.
No.
No, no questions. I just wanted to apologize. Just walking out on you.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you. It's fine. No, it's very fine. Thank you very much for
thank
your
you
consideration.
Could I have Susan Corn then, please? Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Representative, or Chairman Brown and members of the committee. I want to speak to you from a first-person perspective and give you some of my perspective on the identity, the credit freeze bill, and some of the issues of identity theft. Basically, I, my neighbors, my friends, and other Oregonians have been hurt by identity theft, by credit card fraud, and the like. A small bit of background, I am one of the founders and the webmistress for the Mountford Coalition Against Drug Crime, www.hadit.org. You can go there to see some of the issues of drug crime. And part and parcel of that is the drug house that was across the street from me. The bank foreclosed, and when they tested, it was tested positive for meth in every room. It was purchased by one of the neighbors. When they had it torn down, they found stolen property, they found stolen mail, they found a lot of stolen material. And this was the house across the street from me. That's an aside because that's not directly on the identity theft. My personal experience really started the day in July 22nd, when I opened my American Express bill. And there in the American Express bill was this little extra $7,375.70. Nothing like having the $7,000 added to your what you expected to be a small credit card bill to get your attention. Immediately.
Susan, my wife had accused me of being loose with a credit card.
Well, that could be. But in this case, it wasn't me. And when I called American Express, I found out that there was already in the 5 or 6 days since they issued the bill, an additional $3,100 added to the bill. They were just ramping up and going strong. And, of course, American Express immediately cut them off, issued me a new card. When I talked with them later, it turned out that as late as 6 months later, people were still trying to use the card. And poor Cyber Rebate, because they weren't terribly smart and didn't ship stuff to billing address, was shipping about $500 to $600 a day of computer equipment to Phoenix, Arizona by the end of this period. I know. I have the credit card receipts showing that. And they, when it was billed back to them, they called me and they said, didn't you loan your card to somebody in Phoenix? No, I don't think so. Well, we called the number. It was disconnected. We called the number at the address, and they denied receiving anything. But what really torqued me about the usage of the credit card was the catalogs for X-rated videos that started arriving in my mailbox, because one of the charges, when I went back and looked, was to a place in South Carolina that sends out X-rated videos, and they figured that my name and home address was now a good place to send catalogs. It turned out that a call to them and explaining that they were never paid for those things, that I would never order anything, got them to stop it after just three more. Another thing that happened very relatively recently was my neighbor looked out the window on Christmas Day and saw that somebody was being generous and picking up all the holiday mail that was left in the mailboxes by people on vacation. Being on the Neighborhood Watch program, she ran out, got the license plate and make of the car, phoned it into 911, and about 10 or 15 minutes later, that car was pulled over. The back seat of the car was stacked high with mail that had been stolen out of mailboxes from people on Christmas vacation. And they were people, when they went back to their homes, they found out with a search warrant that they were involved in identity theft. They were going to use my neighbor's mail to create credit cards, driver's license, and the like, whatever they could figure out how to do with it. My medical insurance provider, I spent 23 years working at Intel. Every time you use a PC, you're probably using some of my work. I had a long-running joust with Cigna and Intel to try and get them to remove my Social Security number from my medical card. I did not want to get in an accident and go into some emergency room and be there reciting my Social Security number next to the gang members who had gotten shot and their friends and cohorts and everybody else who happened to be there, or have it put on my chart where anybody walking by. Intel and pointed to Cigna, Cigna pointed to Intel, and they sort of never did anything. That is, until this year, after California said you can't do that anymore, I finally got a medical card that does not have my Social Security number on it for the first time in 15 years of trying. And I want that to be the case for every Oregonian, that their Social Security number is not publicly displayed on their medical records. A friend of mine in New York got one of the infamous Choice Point letters. He gets his letter. He says, guess what? Your personal information is available to these people who are ne'er-do-wells. And he's there going, what should I do? I can't do anything about it other than be here paranoid, scared, checking my credit report as often as I possibly can think about doing it. And what else is he going to do? There's no way for him to freeze it to say, no, do not issue credit in my name unless you have explicit authorization out of channel. But Choice Point had a lot of people, and as I understand it, they waited 5 months before they let any of them know. And while only a relatively small number of people got impacted, those people didn't know until they opened up their credit card bills, until credit card bills didn't show up as they were rerouted and the like. And I just read in the paper, LexisNexis said, oh, yeah, by the way, we lost them too. But we haven't notified anybody yet. So has my record been sent out? I don't know. Has your record been sent out? Is somebody out there right now making up a driver's license with your name on it, your address on it, and going down to DMV to change your address to get credit cards in your name? I don't know. LexisNexis doesn't know. And who knows what's going to come out later. What we need, what I as a citizen need, what my neighbors need, what my friend in New York needs, but that's not your problem, that's his, is I need to be able to freeze my credit report. I don't want credit issued in my name unless I explicitly walk up and say, hey, I'm interested in credit. The second thing I need is for people to keep my confidential information, my personal credit persona, confidential. Don't publish it on charts in the hospital. The third thing I need is, if they do have a problem, I want to know about it so I can be on double guard against things appearing in the mail. I don't want to be surprised 6 months later when I discover that my credit information has been stolen, that somebody has a credit card in my name, that somebody's shipping $500 a day to Phoenix, Arizona. I also want to be able to see what's in my credit report in case there are problems that have snuck in. And finally, I want to see a business relationship between anybody issuing credit and me, even if it's somebody else using my name in vain to get credit for themselves. I just read where the courts have decided that, well, if somebody else is getting credit in my name, I don't have a business relationship, and so the credit agencies do not have a business relationship with me and do not have to have due diligence for me. I view that my credit persona is, in fact, me. And if somebody is touching that, using it, even looking at it, they have a business relationship with me, and they need to do due diligence to make sure it really is me requesting anything they do. I've heard that there have been some objections, specifically the objection of cost, that this is too hard to implement. Well, I looked at what they did for California, and yeah, that's a pretty clunky way to do it. But I've also pulled down my annual credit report from at least two credit agencies, and that's the right way to do it. It's clear the credit agencies know how to make this easy, know how to be able to let people interact over the web. If I can look at my credit report online over the web, costing them no people interaction and just a little tiny bit of machine time, surely I can set a flag at that point saying, no, don't show this to anybody else unless I come in with my password and my PIN. And by the way, send me something in the mail saying I'm doing this. They've also said that it constrains companies from offering people trivially easy credit. Well, the credit card reporting agencies, if they set it up so that people can electronically enable and disable it, if they put their mind to it, if they try and think through how to make it easy, like they did the annual credit report, then I'm sure they'll be able to solve that in some clever way, since there's a fair chunk of money on the line. And the biggest objection I've heard is it's not their problem. It's the consumer's problem if somebody else steals their credit identity. Well, it's my credit persona. I want to be able to control it. I think it's mine. I think they need to respect my wishes and make it their problem if they, through their lack of due diligence, let somebody else use it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Gitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Corwin, I'm deeply sorry for your troubles that you've gone through. They are paramount. I'm starting with I have multiple, and I'll ask for follow-up. My first question is in the personal experience section of your testimony with the American Express, the Christmas Day, your medical insurance provider, and Choice Point. I'm failing to see how stopping a credit. I'm failing to see how it corresponds with what the bill does. I don't think I think somebody would still stop at the mailbox and potentially steal your mail, and there's the other thing. So if you could bridge the two
there's
for me.
There's two separate things, absolutely. One is the credit card fraud, where they got my credit card number and used it. And I will note, American Express and the credit card companies seem to be doing very well in supporting the consumer in contesting issues on it. And so, I mean, it was great working with American Express. I made a spreadsheet. I sent it to them. I said, these are mine. These are not mine. And they took care of it. What it didn't do is allow me to make sure that somebody with my credit card number didn't get my additional information and then start opening additional credit cards in my name that I wouldn't know about. The credit card fraud is just the tip of an iceberg. Underneath the water is the ability to take somebody's credit persona and use it for their own benefit.
Follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you. There is a cost incurred. I personally, on my credit, I pay $9.95 every month to a company to monitor my credit, and if there's anything that's changed on my credit, they notify me, and I can view it online. Do you think that if we require these companies, I think one of them is called, just as an example, TransUnion.
Right.
If we say that this to them, that don't show this to anybody, do you think that they should be required, or should be able to charge a fee for providing you that service, similar to the fee that I pay on the other end?
Given that what I'm requesting is they basically do not display it, I see no problem with a small fee to freeze it and a small fee to unfreeze it. But while it's sitting there basically unused, I'd be very reluctant to pay a rental fee for them holding my credit persona on a couple hundred bytes on a monstrously big disk that doesn't cost them much anything anymore, thanks to the technology curves that have occurred.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You very much for taking the time and hearing about my problems.
Thank you. Going to have Corey Schlesinger and Cheryl Pellegrini, please.
Mr. Chair, I believe these are Representative Smith's amendments we received, and Katie just made copies, House Bill 2412-1 amendment, and it appears to give require the consumer reporting agency to notify within 5 business days on the file if someone in the consumer's file if someone has possibly attempted an unauthorized use of the consumer's identity. And Mr. Chair, I don't know too much other than that about the amendment.
And these are Representative Smith's?
I believe so.
Okay, thank you. Corey, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and to my left is David Patman, who's the Deputy Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I'm here today to offer comments on this bill and also the general concepts and to support the general concept of a security freeze, although we think that there are some technical issues in the bill that probably could use some work. As you've heard, this is one of the concepts that's aimed at preventing identity theft, which is a growing problem nationally and in Oregon. There have been a number of very well-publicized incidents recently, Choice Point, LexisNexis, Bank of America. Oregon actually always ranks on the top of the list for identity theft problems. I think we're one of the top 10 states consistently, and identity theft has nationally topped the list of consumer fraud problems for, I believe, 5 straight years. The particular concept here of a security freeze would be of assistance in a couple different ways. The Choice Point situation, wrongdoers actually created fake businesses that then went to Choice Point and requested data about consumers. That is, these fake businesses pretended to be inquiring about their customers, and Choice Point then supplied them with the data about people from their database. These perpetrators then were able to use that data for identity theft purposes. So one purpose that this bill would serve would be to allow a consumer to decline to have their information provided to a customer without their consent, so that that fake business would not have been able to get the data unless they had a real customer who really wanted that data to be shared. In addition, as some of your witnesses have testified, if you as a consumer are in a situation where you think that you might be a victim of identity theft, your mail was stolen. You don't know what happened to it, but it was stolen. You could freeze your account data with these various entities so that it would not be supplied to the person who stole the mail. It would only be supplied in connection with transactions that you were familiar with. There are a number of other identity theft concepts, one of which may be represented in the amendments you've just seen. We have not seen those amendments, but one of the issues in that Choice Point situation involved notification. And in California, which has a bill, has legislation similar to this, in California, they had a requirement that when one of these credit reporting entities becomes aware that an individual's data has been stolen, they do have to notify that individual. And that's why notices were sent. Choice Point, actually, as a result of some outcry, ended up notifying all of the customers whose records were stolen, not just the California customers, as they were originally intending to do. So the Senate side actually has a package of bills, Senate bills 626 and the following series, I believe, which address the security freeze that 2412 addresses, address the issue of notifying customers when data has been stolen, and a couple of other of the issues that keep coming up in identity theft, like use of social security numbers. And, you know, the problem is a complex one. It's not subject to a single, simple solution. And it's also complex because in this modern day and age, people make a great deal of use of this type of data for normal business transactions. You'll probably hear from members of the financial community about concerns about some aspects of this bill, and we share some of those concerns. And we think that there are solutions, though, and we would certainly welcome an opportunity to work with stakeholders to come up with what will work without interfering with normal business transactions that people appreciate the opportunity to have. I want to address one specific issue in this bill. As I think I mentioned, similar legislation is in place in 4 or 5 other states at least, and a number of others are considering it. California and Texas have similar legislation. We would suggest that if you do choose to move forward with legislation like this, you consider conforming some of the technical details to the California legislation, because these are national entities, and if they have a system set up, they don't want to have to set up a different system for Oregon. California is pretty big. If they have a system set up to comply with California's laws on number of days to do this and that and what you have to do in terms of passwords and so on, that system already exists. We wouldn't want them to have to set up a different system just for Oregon. So that's one comment we would leave you with. In addition, most of the other states that have gone in this direction do not have a regulatory agency involved. This bill, the way it's drafted, would have our department, actually one of the ways to enforce the bill would be regulatory action through our department. The bill also provides enforcement under the Uniform or the Unfair Trade Practices Act and through private right of action. We have some concerns about the agency involvement piece of this. That's not the way that other states have primarily handled this. We think Nevada does have a regulatory agency involved. We have not been able to, despite repeated efforts, we haven't been able to get hold of the folks in Nevada who are in that role. There's no funding associated with it, and we don't have general fund and any funds that are other than specific program dedication. In addition, because most of these companies are not located in Oregon, we actually have some qualms about whether we'd be able to enforce it. We don't really see ourselves flying to New Jersey or Connecticut or someplace and knocking on the door and saying, hi, we're from Oregon, we'd like to examine your records. We're not really sure that that's a feasible enforcement approach. So we would suggest you consider whether you need a regulatory agency involved or whether Unfair Trade Practices Act and private rights of action are sufficient. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Corey. Representative Stauffer.
Thank you. On the other states in the history, and if you can't speak to it right now, that's fine, but I would like some information on how much all this costs, and those that do regulate it, how much that costs the government, how many people sign up, how effective it is, any unintended consequences, all that stuff I'd like, if you have anything like that. I've had my mail stolen. Knock on wood, I haven't had any of these problems that Ms. Corwin has suffered through. I'm very grateful, safe for me. But I'm concerned about creating some behemoth that doesn't do anything. That concerns me. So if you can give me that information or speak to it now as you wish, in the committee, I'd imagine.
Representative Kitts.
You want to just get him that information? You want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, we will have to see what we can round up and get back to you. I would say that my suspicion is that in light of just what's happened over the past few months, we may see an outpouring of interest here, even if there had not been before. But we will get hold of the California people in particular and ask them those questions.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, please.
Representative Schaffler.
Also, there's a new federal law about verification of documents, and I think some of that will take care of some of this. Maybe is that a possibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'm not quite sure I know in terms of verification of documents what you're referring to.
I was just talking to someone from the Idaho Department of Transportation this morning about folks having to verify their Social Security number to get a driver's license in Idaho. Now, Ms. Corwin spoke at length about her Social Security number, identity, and somehow there's some new federal law just passed, President signed, about you have to verify your documentation, and hopefully, I don't know if credit cards, I don't know how lengthy they'll go to this, where you have to verify something to use your credit card, but I wonder if that'll in any way have an effect, a positive effect, to help avoid folks like Ms. Corwin suffering through her problems. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'll have to get back to you on that specific point, but there's no question that there's a lot of additional federal regulation going into play in this area. HIPAA has really restricted use of various types of data in the medical context. A lot of companies and entities are moving away from use of Social Security number. I'm a state employee. I just got my new medical ID card, which no longer uses my Social Security number as an identifier. The state of Oregon no longer uses Social Security numbers as an identifier. On these credit identity theft issues, there are congressional hearings going on as we speak, and it may well be that we see additional federal legislation. Of course, the FACT Act, which is fairly recent, addressed a number of issues having to do with access to credit reports. So I'll look into that specific issue, but there's no question there's an increasing federal attention here.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Corey. I want to make sure that we're not putting symbolism over substance here. And I say that because having served on the Public Safety Coordinating Council for Washington County, the information that I get from my sheriff directly is that 100% of the identity theft cases in Washington County are directly related to meth. Okay, and we saw it on the TV last night where there was a ring of meth perpetrators, you know, meth users out there that stole thousands and thousands of copper wire from PGE to sell it to Meltdown to fund this habit. You know, the issues that we're talking about, mail theft,
I mean, these are issues that I don't think the bill as is addresses, and I was trying to read through Representative Smith's amendments, but I haven't made it through all of them yet. Do you think that the bill as is really going to address the problem of identity theft? I mean, it seems that it has nothing to do with stolen mail. You know, it's where people are getting personal information, bank statements, you know, credit cards that may come in the mail. I'm just not seeing how it. I'm having a hard time building the bridge by going after the credit reporting companies and identity theft. So maybe you, from your perspective, could help me. And Ms. Kwan, I'm not saying that you didn't build the bridge. I'm still got fuzzy math in my head. So maybe you could elaborate on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, first of all, identity theft is a multifaceted problem. I mean, it is certainly the case that neither this bill nor any other bill is the solution that's going to solve it. It's very challenging. This bill is addressed at a couple of aspects of it, and the use that is made of the information once it's stolen. And there's first level, and then there's second level, different levels of sophistication of identity thieves. The person who is going to steal your credit card and use it to run up charges, as the prior witness testified, this bill won't address that situation. That is theft of a credit card, and the person's going to run up charges, and until you get it stopped, that's going to happen. The question is, what about those more sophisticated identity thieves, which is a growing trend in this country, the people who are setting up fake identities and then using them. So there's, again, it's a multifaceted problem, and to different degrees in different areas. Some of the most tragic situations, though, are the people whose identities literally are stolen. Not just a credit card, but their electronic persona, so to speak. Their name, social security number, address, driver's license number, and the other things that identify them in the financial world have been hijacked and used to open new accounts, which are then used to run up big charges, which the financial world associates with them as a human being. And that is one of the issues that this bill is aimed at addressing. Again, it is certainly not a complete or perfect solution.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
Now, I spoke earlier of the service that I have, because this is a huge issue for me. I mean, I want to make sure that people are protected out there, but I also want to make sure that if we're passing on requirements to anybody, I don't care if it's these big, ugly corporate, you know, credit consumer people or not, which are no friends of mine, but I want to make sure that we're getting to the problem. And in my situation, with this service that I have, that I pay $10 a month, online, I can view my credit report at any point in time that I want, and if any changes, if any inquiries, if any changes, if anything changes on my credit report, I'm notified instantly. Wouldn't that have, in Ms. Gorman's case, or in some of these cases that you're talking about, wouldn't that address the problem? I mean, aren't there mechanisms out there currently that would address this particular problem as related to credit bureaus? Because, again, I don't want to put symbolism over substance, and I think the identity theft issue is a lot bigger than the consumer reporting, you know, the credit bureaus. Again, I think it relates directly back to the meth with my personal experience, not my personal experience, but the experience that I've had in dealing with these issues. So would the service that I have stop and address the problems that I guess the bill is trying to address?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I'm not sure I can answer that. The service that you have is certainly another valuable tool. And I think the issue is what level of choices should be available to consumers in controlling how data relating to them and their personal lives should be used. And so it's an array of tools. This bill would add a new and different tool.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Corey? Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I serve in the department's financial fraud consumer protection section as the attorney in charge. I'll just fill in. I think that the Director Streisinger provided the a lot of good information to fill in behind Ms. Corwin. Let me just provide a little bit more. The Federal Trade Commission each year comes out with a report in national trends in fraud and identity theft. For its report for the period January 1 through December 31, 2004, there were 3,156 Oregon victims of identity theft. Of those, 26% were victimized via bank fraud, 26% were victimized via credit card fraud, 18% were victimized via phone or utilities fraud, meaning that people signed up for utilities or phone service in the name of an Oregonian. 8% were employment-related fraud, 6% were government documents or benefits fraud, 4% were loan fraud, 22% were other, and there was an instance of 8% attempted identity theft. Also, it's notable that Oregon, given our size within the country, per capita, we rank 9th among the nation for instances of identity theft. It's because, as Representative Kitts mentioned, we do have a burgeoning meth problem, and the meth trade is financed in part through funds that is generated by the theft of personal identity and then the reselling of that. It's called profile information on a black market. And they do with it exactly as Director Streisinger said, that your information is sold to people who will then compile a new profile using bits of your identity. And they will open new credit cards, not using your existing cards, but they will open new cards. They will obtain bank loans for cars and houses. And you won't know sometimes. You won't get a bill in the mail that shows an unauthorized charge for $7,000. You won't know until perhaps you go to buy a new house and you find out that there's already another loan out for a residential structure in your name. With that backdrop, how does House Bill 2412 fit in? Here it is. It underscores the need for consumers to be able to exert some control over who has access to the report. The ability to freeze your credit report and control who may extend credit to you is, I think, one of the most important things that we could do for individual consumers. It's self-enforcing. It does not rely, and I think a good argument could be made that it should not rely on any government entity, that it should be self-enforcing, that people, for a modest fee or a reasonable fee, should be able to dictate who their credit report should be extended to, who should have access to it for the purpose of extending them credit. It's similar to laws currently, and California has been mentioned. There's also Texas, Louisiana, and Vermont. Although Texas and Vermont are limited to victims of identity theft. And in that way, they're similar to the Federal FACT Act. You may hear about the FACT Act from some of the opponents of this bill who may argue that we don't need it. Federal law already provides for a credit freeze. But the FACT Act provides for a credit freeze if you have been a victim of identity theft, you file an identity theft report, and what the FACT Act then provides for is it will put a fraud alert into a consumer's credit file that will warn potential users that they should not extend credit before verifying the entity or the identity of the individual requesting credit. It also blocks reporting of any information placed into a consumer's credit file that the consumer has identified as information that has resulted from an instance of identity theft, and that's on a entry-by-entry basis. It does not preempt the ability of state laws to pass more protective legislation such as this, which would allow any consumer to freeze their entire report as a protective measure rather than as an after-the-fact measure. And in closing, I would just note two things. One, a good example of the need for this bill. You know, there's been a security breach within LexisNexis database. There are 210 Oregonians whose information is out there. Nobody knows who those 210 Oregonians are. But if this bill was in place, you can bet that I would be placing a freeze on my credit in the event I was one of those people. That's what this bill would do for us. One point in closing, Section 3, sub 8, and I agree with the Department of Consumer Business Services that there are some provisions here that may need further refinement to address industry concerns on the one hand and to address some state agency concerns and government concerns on the other. I would just note that Section 3, sub 8, it seems to imply that a consumer may remedy a violation by filing a complaint either with the Department of Consumer and Business Services or with the Attorney General's office. Reading that, it seems to imply, it could be taken to imply, that upon filing a complaint, either of those agencies is actually mandated to take some action on behalf of an individual consumer to remedy that complaint. And at least with regard to the Department of Justice, we cannot represent the rights of or the interests of individual consumers. Chapter 180 prohibits us from that. What we do is that we do collect complaints from consumers, and if we see a pattern emerge, then that may direct an enforcement action by us. So we would just ask that provision perhaps be clarified to match what our statutory charge is. I have nothing further. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Cheryl. This is, I think, and Representative Kitts has said that it's getting at just one small part of the identity theft issue altogether. The other couple nights ago on TV, they were showing an identity theft ring that was broke up, I think it was in the Hillsborough area, and they showed that they had a driver's license with this person's picture on about a dozen different driver's licenses that they could, you know, fit that description on there, and then they had credit cards issued to those same people's names. How did they come by all that information to...
Mr. Chair, boy, a whole host of ways. As Ms. Corwin testified, people steal mail. If there are purses in cars, I mean, they're now. It used to be people would steal purses because there was money in the purse. Now people steal purses because there's personal identification information in a purse. Security. There are a number of scams over the internet. Ms. Streisand just mentioned phishing. You've seen it. You'll get a notice from what would purport to be Wells Fargo or KeyBank that says, we have just experienced an irregularity in your account in conducting an internal audit. We need to verify your information. You've got to provide us your account information. If you don't do so, you know, we're going to have to freeze your account. And so people go to the site, which is a false site, and type in their bank account information, their address, name, date of birth, hit send, and that goes to the site of a thief. In addition, I mean, hacking into personal or to proprietary databases has become quite common. Employees of businesses that collect information from consumers, everyone from, you know, restaurants to hospitals, they will steal that information from their employers because personal information right now is an extremely valuable commodity. There's an entire shadow market in the United States and globally for false personal information. 2412 doesn't solve all of those. Oh, and then there's dumpster diving. You know, everybody in Oregonia, I mean, we all recycle. Not a lot of people still... Many people don't shred their bank statements. They put them out with their recycles every other week, and thieves come by and just pilfer through recycle bins, and they do the same thing to businesses that dump their paper trash out in a dumpster at the end of the day. What 2412 will do is that it will create a choke point, I think. in that if people start to put freezes that access this sort of a service and freeze their report, in the event their identity is stolen, no good use will be able to be made of it, because there's a disconnect between having credit, having personal information, and then the ability to get a lender to extend credit, because the missing link is the lender's ability to access the person's credit report. If they can't do that, they're not going to extend credit. So I think that it's just one small piece in a much larger array of remedies that perhaps are needed to address this issue.
And you know, this is probably getting a little far afield with this here, but it would seem to me that what I've seen on TV there with these people, they identified that the important piece of identification was your driver's license, and so they had that there first to support all these other documents to rip off whoever they were. And it seemed like to me that one of the first things we should get at then is really as how to make that driver's license a more valuable and verifiable piece of identification. And Oregon, I think, probably leads the nation in having probably the most sloppiest system in issuing driver's license.
Mr. Chair, actually it was New Jersey until they removed Social Security numbers from it a couple of years ago. But I know that, and perhaps this is a conversation that the committee may want to engage the Department of Transportation, Division of Motor Vehicles in. I know that there has been some discussion over the past few sessions about adding additional biometric measures to driver's licenses to make them harder to reproduce. So,
thank you, Cheryl. Any questions? Representative Kitts.
I had one question, and forgive me if it lingers here. I feel like I'm taking all the time, which I probably am. When I'm looking at the abuses of identity, which is basically the numbers that you outline, it appears that about 40% in just adding the numbers that are provided along here would not be addressed by this bill. 40% of these cases, and I cite things like government documents, phone or utilities fraud, employment-related fraud, which I would think in most of those cases credit reports aren't required or sought after. I don't think that I know that my credit wasn't checked when I did my utilities. Maybe some are, maybe some aren't. Or when I apply for a job, I don't think that my credit is run in those situations. It also adds up to 91%, not a full 100%, so we're missing 8% of these other abuses. I guess my bigger question, knowing that 40% wouldn't be addressed by this bill, the other 51% that is identified here, it would seem that to me that there are measures right now. I mean, I don't want to say upon applying for credit, one must purchase a shredder, one must purchase a lock for their mailbox, and one must sign up for the same service that I have at $9.95 a month. Because I think that if you were to require those three things of the consumer, it probably would address the other 51% of these issues. But that being said, you're going to have people that are going to have bolt cutters that are going to cut those locks off, and systems to reconstruct shredded documents. I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. Unfortunately, that applies both in the real world and the criminal world. So I just point that out, and thank you for your time today.
Representative Eskimo.
Well, these people that steal your identity are very, very almost arrogant about it. We had a situation, you probably remember this, is in Jackson County. We had an individual that was in jail that was getting information from his attorneys on witnesses and people that were alleging that he did his crimes on a witness list. Of course, it had their Social Security number, and he was working on the inside at public, using a public phone that was paid for by the public, working with someone outside and stealing the identity of the witnesses that were coming against him. So it doesn't take much, evidently, to do this. I mean, it really doesn't. So that shows you how blatant they are about it.
Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something pops into my mind. I always think about it from time to time. Do you think the financial institutions in our country are somewhat proliferating identity theft? You know, I constantly get mail issuing me a credit card of people I've never even heard of. And they and the card's in the mail with account numbers in my name, and, you know, and the mail isn't necessarily safe or anything because I don't have a lock on my mailbox, but I will by tomorrow probably, for anybody listening. I'm just kind of wondering, you know, it seems like, you know, our financial community is sending out accounts all over the place, you know, without being requested, and I don't think this bill addresses that either. Is that a concern, or do you see that as being a problem in this discussion, or is...
Both might take a crack at that. Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I don't know that I can comment on behalf of the Department of Justice whether or not it's a problem. I mean, bank, financial institutions and their affiliates are allowed under federal law, at least, to market credit cards and other products to consumers. This bill would address that, though, because if you put a credit freeze on your report, then you wouldn't get those solicitations in the mail. Mm-hmm. It would stop them. You would only receive solicitations from those institutions or entities that you listed. And I don't know if it's under 2412 or there's another bill, Senate Bill 627, that's very similar to this, but there's an existing business relationship exemption too. So anyone who you currently have a credit card with or a loan, they could continue to contact you. Anyone who you said you wanted to receive information from or offers from, they could contact you. But it would have put a stop to all of the unsolicited applications or pre-approved credit offers, I think is probably what you're talking about, mm-hmm. or they send live checks in the mail. Certainly, it's a problem insofar as, you know, people are receiving these in their mail, they don't have lock boxes, and their mail is a subject of theft, because then thieves have all the paperwork, an application that is complete but for a signature, in some cases for a pre-authorized account for, you know, $10,000 or $15,000. So, I mean, inadvertently, I mean, it certainly does have that effect of contributing to the problem.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. On the solicitations, for one thing, they're keeping the wood fiber industry going, which is good. But and believe me, I'm serious. They get more paper than you can shake a stick at. But I get solicitations with my name misspelled. I get solicitations with the first name of a girlfriend I had in college with my last name. So even if I froze this, it wouldn't stop the solicitations. And I understand they should run your credit after you apply, so you'd probably already have to unfreeze your data before, if you did respond to one of those things. But that really is not what I wanted to ask you about. Ms. Pellegrini, whatever we do in this building, in any issue, I want us to be effective. And if it's not effective, and I don't want a bunch of unintended consequences, and that's, I think, our goal in everything, if it's not going to be effective, then I really hesitate. And you said, and I believe you, Texas is one of the states that has it, and California. Yet they are third and fourth in the country, victim per 100,000 population of identity theft. And probably because they got meth heads all over the place, unfortunately, like we do. But I'm concerned about creating something that isn't going to stop the problem, and then putting unintended consequences, burden on consumer, burden on business. We're doing everything in this state we can to bring people into this state to do business and help the economy, and I'm concerned about that. I want to stop what happened to Ms. Corwin. I want to stop that tomorrow. And I'd hang the varmints from the flagpole over there if I had my way, but I don't get my way. But that's my concern about all this. If we're just reaching out for solutions, and we're not stopping the problem. And this graph here shows me we're not stopping it, even with this system. So, and how do we do that? I don't know. But I'm concerned about creating something it's not going to be effective, and put a bunch of unintended consequences that put a burden on business and the consumer.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Schaffler has really touched on a far bigger problem, and that is ex-girlfriends from college. I'm deeply concerned, as is Representative Schaffler, about this ever-growing problem. So I'm willing to work with him in a bipartisan way to stop this problem.
It's deteriorating.
Right. I think we'll move on. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Could I have Cindy Roberts, Jim Marquis, and Julie Brandis, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the National Association of Credit Management, which serves Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Southwest Idaho. I'm here today because I have some issues with this bill, but more importantly, Mr. Marquis scares me, and I thought if I didn't come, I'd be in a lot of trouble, even though I'm sick and I'm going home to bed after I talk to you today. Besides the obvious problems I think you've all pointed out today, the paperwork, the costs, this liability issues, costs that would be pushed onto the consumers, I have three issues I want to talk to you about where I have concern. One has to do with ownership. One has to do with current restrictions, and the third has to do with objectivity. Fact is, you earn your credit score, but you don't own it. It's like a reputation. You earn it, but you don't own it. You can't decide who gets to know about it and who doesn't. This is the only way that a lot of businesses have of determining whether or not to do business with you is through this credit report. It's a simple fact. Number two, on current restrictions, the Fair Credit Reporting Act already restricts who and when a credit report can be given to, and this bill would block a company with a federally recognized legitimate reason to access an individual's credit report from doing so. Third, objectivity. This is a different way of thinking of this. When it comes to credit reports, it's the only real thing that we have in the system of deciding if someone should get a loan for a car, a house, anything. It's the only real way we have to compare people on the same level, not because of where they grew up, how old they are, what color they are, what job they do, but the same factors. That's what a credit report does. It considers the same factors for everyone as to whether or not they should receive credit. I think that there's a lot of problems with identity theft. I think they've been pointed out here. DMV, garbage dumping, mail theft. I think these are being addressed in other bills. So this bill, however, I think brings more problems upon the issue than what it solves. Therefore, I'm hoping that you'll see that this bill isn't going to do the things we'd like for it to do and realize that the credit reporting industry is very interested in helping in areas where we can help.
Representative Chaffler.
Ms. Robert, and for you, I should have asked Ms. Pellegrini this question too. Do you see the federal government going in this direction eventually anyway? And Ms. Pellegrini, if you want.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I do, and I learn everything I have learned about credit reporting from this guy, so I'm sure he'd be happy to answer that for you. But I do. The Fair Credit Reporting Act that just passed is one really big step, and we're trying to work out all the kinks in that right now. Once we have the opportunity to see where it works, where it doesn't work, I'm sure that credit reporters and loan institutions will be happy to fix it some more. This is a dual problem. It not only affects the consumer as far as their identity theft, but it affects the people who loan money. We loan money to people to buy things. We loan it to them for some percentage rate return, but still, it's a loan and we expect to be paid back. My mama taught me to pay people back. This keeps people from doing that the right way.
Thank you, Cindy. The other man there, this man there. Thank you, Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis, today representing TransUnion, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, and the Oregon Collectors Association, all of whom are opposed to this bill for a variety of reasons. I want to say to start, however, that I certainly agree with all of the proponents of this bill that identity theft is rampant across the nation. It's rampant in Oregon, and it's a huge problem that we all need to be concerned about. My clients are concerned about it, and We're trying to move forward in responsible manners to address that at all levels. TransUnion particularly spent a lot of time last year and the year before working with Representative Darlene Hooley from Oregon, who took the lead on behalf of the Democrats, in, at least in the Financial Services Committee in Congress, to enact the reauthorization of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, now known as the FACT Act. That law is relatively new and does address some of the concerns that are attempted to be addressed in this legislation. I think we need to give it some time. I also would like to say that I believe Congress is moving forward now with additional regulation to try to bring more protection to consumers with respect to their credit reports and with respect specifically to identity theft. This bill, I submitted written testimony. I'm not going to go through it paragraph by paragraph, but I want to hit a couple of highlights here. This bill allows, as you've heard, consumers to virtually shut off and turn on their credit report like a faucet through the use of a PIN number issued by the credit reporting agency. This bill, a similar bill, did pass in California. TransUnion spent about $3 million setting up the initial system in California to respond to that legislation. When I talked to our folks in Chicago, the last number I had was about 1,200 people in the whole state had signed up for it. And I like to say 1,200 people signed up for it, and only about 100 of them can remember their PIN number, unfortunately. And it does create some problems. You get the guy who had his water heater blow up on a Saturday, and he's trying to get a new water heater, and he doesn't have any money to pay for it, and he's down at the hardware store, and they want to run his credit because he wants to buy the water heater on credit, and he can't remember his PIN number. So they can't access his credit report, and it's going to take us a week or 10 days to issue a new one. Some of those practical everyday problems are problems that are created for consumers with legislation like this. Internet shopping, the bill contemplates that you would, once you turned off your credit report, you would turn it on for specific people to access. Well, if you go to an internet, so if you're shopping for a mortgage and you go to an internet site that uses will get offers to get quotes from multiple companies for you, you don't know which companies they are, so you can't do it. I mean, it just doesn't work. If you go to a mortgage broker who wants to shop different companies for you, it doesn't work. So there are some practical problems created for consumers that I would classify as unintended consequences. For collection agencies, I find it interesting in the bill, collection agencies, as you know, oftentimes get credit reports on consumers without asking first because they're looking for new information. They're allowed to do so if they're collecting a debt owed to a public body under this bill, but not to a private entity. Question comes to mind, how the heck would the credit reporting agency know who they were collecting for? And collection agencies oftentimes have multiple accounts. We got about $200 million assigned to private collection agencies that are owed, the money that's owed to the state of Oregon. Many of those people who owe money to the state of Oregon also owe JCPenney's or somebody else money. So one of my collection agencies gets the information for the money owed to the public entity. Are they not permitted to use the information on the private account that they have for the same guy? We don't know. I mean, it's just unknown. And for the credit reporting agency, how are they going to verify that it's money owed to a public entity? It just completely doesn't work. Obviously, one of the provisions in the bill says that this would be a free service offered by credit reporting agencies, and the company I represent is a for-profit company, and they're not real keen about doing this for free. I understand why people would want it for free. Interestingly, Section 2, Sub 8 of this bill says that, I believe it says it's an unfair trade violation for an individual to take an adverse action because somebody used this law to shut their credit report down. An adverse action includes denial of credit. So if a retailer or somebody else out there denied a consumer credit because they couldn't access their credit report because the consumer himself shut it down, I think they'd be in violation of the Oregon Unfair Trade Practices Act, which seems a little odd to me. I mean, it's kind of a catch-22. I think there are some check verification companies that would fall under the definition of a credit reporting agency as defined in this bill, which actually might work contrary to the intent of helping with the identity theft problem. We might not be able to access check fraud information on individuals through those companies as a result of this legislation. And that's a problem. And then we get to the part where credit reporting agencies have to notify consumers anytime they change any information in the file, which includes address. Now, I'm told by TransUnion that we get about 42 million address changes a year across the country. So every time somebody changed their address and we changed it in the file, we'd have to send them 42 million notices. Marriages, 3-4 million a year. Divorces. All of those things would require notices to the consumer, which, of course, is an expense to the folks that have to do it. Identity theft people do get innovative, and one of the things that one of the new slick little deals that they're proposing, and there's some people on the internet actually have some sites that will show you how to do this. I won't tell you where they are because one of you might do it. But they propose that you go to the Social Security Administration and get yourself an employer ID number. And then use that to set up a credit file with a little bit of a name. I mean, you know, you use just alter your name just a little bit. Instead of James I, it's Jim or whatever it is. And then you set up this new file. Well, what a perfect deal for those guys, because now not only can you set up the new file, but you get to block the old file entirely. So nobody can ever see it. So it's going to make that process easier for those people engaging in that particular activity. So, those are some of the problems that I see as I move through the bill. Again, I want to say that identity theft is a huge problem and we ought to try to address it. I don't think this is the bill to address it. I think this bill is flawed in major ways. I would like to comment on the chair's remarks earlier, specifically about driver's licenses. We are one of the highest identity theft states in the nation, and I think there are some reasons for it. I don't think it's credit reports. And I served on a identity theft task force for about 3 years. I finally quit going because I didn't feel like we were moving forward in the direction I wanted to move. But I would just say that some of the stories I heard from law enforcement officers, and maybe you ought to have some of those law enforcement officers in here to talk to you about identity theft and some of the things that they see on a daily basis. There was a law enforcement agency that just for the fun of it ran a check, created a little software and ran a check just to see how many people in Oregon they could find that had 7 or more Oregon driver's licenses. And there was about 40 of them. We're one of the few states around that doesn't even require that you be here legally to get a driver's license. You don't have to have a legal presence in Oregon to get a driver's license. That's not one of our deals. We don't offer any biometrics. I mean, I'm so, and believe me, these driver's licenses are a port of entry for identity theft. So, I mean, there are lots of things we could do on identity theft, and I'd certainly be happy to work with the committee on behalf of all of my clients on that. But I don't think this bill is the vehicle.
Thank you. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. And it's just right there, your last words I wanted to talk to. Government is going to be forced into doing something about this, clearly. Something, and we may hurt people's feelings along the way. People may not get everything they want. But and I know we're doing that stuff doing federal level, state, local levels. What I would like from all of you that do oppose the bill, and this bill may not be what we're looking for, may not be the answer to these problems, but I would like some information, and you don't have to give it today because I didn't give you a heads up on this, but showing me what your clients are doing about it. And I think that's something, that story needs to be told too. I'd assume that there is a story there. What your clients in the consumer reporting industry are doing proactively on their own with their own money to prevent this and help prevent things like Ms. Corwin's problems. And it's all our problem, but that story I think needs to be told too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, I'm going to provide you with as much information as you want, probably more, and we're going to kill a lot of trees doing it.
I'm from the wood pine forest.
We do spend a lot of money on this every year.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Julie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis, representing Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. It's interesting. Yesterday, we're moving offices around AOI, and I was cleaning out a personnel file of mine and took on the retail job in 1996, and the first thing my boss made me do was go to a training seminar in Chicago about how our members utilize credit, how they issue credit, so I was prepared. And then Jim Marquis taught me everything I knew. Anyway, I think it's important to note that I still had a lot of the information. And the world of credit, the world of ID theft has changed so much in just what to me has seemed like a very short time. But, you know, the first question when you think about protecting your ID, and I've given this speech so many times in the Senate, this is actually the first time I've gotten to talk about it over on the House side, but protecting your ID theft, the first and most important thing you can tell your constituents, and I think that's really, you serve an important role in helping in this issue, because I think you're going to be a point of contact with constituents. Encourage them to check their credit report annually, quarterly, biannually. Do it yourselves if you haven't. Promise me, if you haven't, go up to your offices and do it. And I will tell you how I got to this point. My husband and I must have like this target on our back that says, ID theft victims, they love it. And the first time we were ever subjected to ID theft, the one good thing we had in our court was our my husband's trust fund that had been raided by somebody in the Bronx. And what had happened was our company, who in the end provided so much help that manages my husband's accounts, a bag of mail was stolen from their loading dock. And it included everything you could imagine about my husband. You know, everything from his mother's maiden name to, you know, all his credit card reissuing for the year, those types of things. And what happened is somebody in the Bronx was getting new credit. The credit company alerted the guy who handles our accounts. And he said, you know, John Brandis would never travel further east than Livingston, Montana. This is not John. John is not in the Bronx. And they put a stop on it, but we did suffer some damage. What happened is the stock company went to work for us and told us all of these steps that we needed to take to protect our identity from this point on into eternity. And I think that's really important. And one of the most important things in protecting our identity has been our credit report. And so what we did is what you can do voluntarily now without passing comprehensive legislation that I think will have unintended consequences, and that is to put a block on your credit report. And a perfect example of how that works, we did it. We went through all the procedures. A couple months ago, I'm in Portland, and I have a desire to go into the Banana Republic and buy a lot of stuff. And they said, you know, if you buy get a Banana Republic card today, you know, we're going to give you 20% off. And I did the math, and I don't seem worthy. It seemed like a pretty good idea at the time. And it took a very long time that day. It took about a half hour for me to get that approved because I had a block on my credit report. Now, there's a reason for me to have that block. So what ended up happening is they had to ask me a bunch of questions, which my husband and I had set up ahead of time that we both knew the answer to. We threw out the one about where was your first date because we could not come to agreement on it. So that being said, we were able to... you know, I was able to get the Banana Republic closed that day, and I was also able to get the 20% discount. Customers will not have that benefit under this legislation because they will have a number that they will forget. It won't be set up in a system where there's a handful of people who need this protection because of a very broad identity theft, as my husband and I suffered. So those things are, you know, come to my my thought when we think about this type of legislation. Retailers want to serve their customers. They want to serve them quickly. They want to offer deals to their customers for taking out credit. And the customers also want that. We know that. Retailers generally don't offer mail credit offers. You come into the store, you buy all your Christmas presents, and then they say, if you take out a gift certificate if you take out credit today, we'll save you 15%. If you just bought, you know, $100 worth of your family's Christmas presents, that sounds like a good idea. What you want to have happen is for that to happen and quickly if you can provide the identification. I would also agree with Jim about Section 8. Section 2-8. This is a person may not take adverse action. Think about somebody who's offering an apartment for rent. And let's say they can do either a credit check or require a deposit. Or they want to offer a cell phone on another example. Or they want to offer you a utility. But if they can't check your credit quickly, you're going to have to pay a deposit. Now, is that some way... Is that an adverse action under this legislation? And I would argue that it is. So the one thing, and I again talk about, you know, my personal experience, and this is something I have more background on than anything I can would ever like to. I guess that's this negative. The government has a tendency to want to regulate the good players. And they have a legitimate reason to make sure there are certain laws in place to protect consumers. In doing so, I don't think you solve the ID theft. You're not gonna preclude some guy in the Bronx from stealing our mail. It just isn't gonna happen. What I have always argued is that when I went through this crisis, and if you talk to someone else in the building about ID theft, talk to Brian Doherty. But when I went through this, we had a very strategic investment firm handling this crisis for us. But the tools are very simple. And I think we as legislators and AOI, who has a broad-based organization, need to do a better job of providing a one-stop helpline to get people through this when they know it's happening. And that is something that I have been arguing in this building for a long time. Jim and I argued for it in the ID Theft Task Force. And it's a positive way. It's not a regulatory. It's not burdensome. It doesn't harm consumers. It doesn't harm businesses. And that would be where I would continue to press your efforts, because this is growing. And one piece of legislation today is not going to solve how these very smart people who put their talents to bad use or nefarious uses as opposed to good use, they'll figure out a way around it. Trust me. That concludes my testimony.
Julie, you said that you put a block on your credit report?
Yes.
Reporting information? What does that do that this bill, or what does this bill do that doesn't do?
Mr. Chair, I knew you'd ask that question, and I think the very big difference is you're not setting up a statewide system to do that. You're not setting up a regulatory system to do that. You can do that now. All you have to do is call and tell them I've been subjected, and Jim, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I've been subjected to some type of fraud, or I fear that I have been subjected to some. You need to provide no proof. You need to provide no police report. All you have to do is call. At least that's been my experience.
Mr. Chair, if I could, Jim Markey again on behalf of TransUnion this time. The FACT Act covers this on the federal level, and it is limited to people who have been victims of identity theft or fraud. The credit reporting agencies are pretty good about putting a fraud alert on reports for people if they request it and they suspect they've been a victim. But we recently had a legislator whose daughter had her purse stolen. And didn't know what to do. Hadn't had any. I mean, nobody showed up buying something with a credit card or something. But it was a concern, and so we took her through that process, and she put a fraud alert on her credit report. You can do that you go to one credit reporting agency, and they're interconnected, and they'll get all three reports blocked for you. What it does is they won't issue a report to anybody without calling you first. There's different kinds of things that you can do, I believe, with that, and I'm not an expert on it because I've never done it, but there are mechanisms in place to do that where you have suspected fraud or you're a victim of identity theft. Now, that doesn't open that up to the general public like this bill does.
So, how long does that block remain on your account?
Mr. Chair, I can't tell you that. I'll include that with the information that we're getting for you. I don't know the answer to that, but I'll find out.
And so if I lost my wallet and I didn't know where it went or how it disappeared, could I call them up and get that block put on there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you could.
I'm just assuming that maybe somebody stole it or might have found it. I don't have to have any kind of police report or anything like that.
Mr. Chairman, you don't even have to call them. You just call me. I'll take care of it for you.
Mr. Chair, just again, another example, since I have the big identity theft target on my back. My daughter has been through a variety of medical testing over the past year, and I won't name the hospital, but somehow their system was tapped into and all of her medical data was taken. And again, it's not my identity was stolen, it was hers, but again, because of the direct link, I didn't even again have to provide any background information to, I think it was TransUnion that I called. Again, immediately they reinstated the fraud that we had initially from our days when we had the theft out of our stock account.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, just before I leave, this issue of each state doing their own thing becomes very problematic for people who are trying to do business across the nation. And one of the reasons that we worked so hard to develop the FACT Act in its present form is that it created a uniform playing field across the nation. And that's very important to a company like TransUnion. We will continue to work with Congress on additional regulations as they're brought up. But for us, it's very important that those be from the federal level and applied evenly across the nation so that we can continue to do business in a reasonable manner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffer.
You know, I wasn't aware you could do that until just now. I'm not an expert at this stuff, but I think one of the things I know it now because I'm sitting here about being able to block in that situation. I think where the problem in a lot of issues in the state and society in general is people don't have the information. Now, I think maybe it's there, maybe they just didn't read it. And that I believe, but I think it should be in big, bold letters. If you're a credit, a lender, a credit card company, a credit reporting business, in big, bold letters, if you feel you have been or if you are a victim of identity theft, you should do and can do, and it's within your rights to do, X, Y, and Z, and here's the phone number. I mean, I think government should provide some kind of helpline, but I think definitely first, private business should be not in fine print. For God's sakes, I can't even see that stuff anymore. But big, bold letters. If this is, you're the consumer, here's what you can do, you should do, if this has happened to you. And somehow get that going. It's all about information. People know what to do, they'll do it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, we employ hundreds of people who do nothing but identity theft stuff, and we do, we have published information, and we've worked with the Federal Trade Commission, who has some great, Federal Trade Commission has great brochures on how to avoid identity theft, what to do if you're a victim, who to call, all of that. I mean, there is a lot of information out there. Sometimes it doesn't get to the right place at the right time, and I understand that. There's probably one other thing here, and that is that when you suspect you're a victim, you actually have to get up off the couch, quit watching the football game, and do something about it. And, you know, there is that side of this, too. You actually have to do something. Pick up the phone and call somebody.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2412? Cheryl, can you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to clarify one point, just to make sure.
Yeah, that reminds me that I had a question about something. I think you're probably going to answer.
For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice. There's just been testimony by Ms. Brandis, Mr. Marquis, that that people can just call and credit, if you just call and ask a credit reporting agency to freeze your account, they'll do that. Well, that's true. And not. It's discretionary. They don't have to. And that was true before the FACT Act provisions were enacted. If you were a victim of identity theft before the FACT Act and you called our credit reporting agencies, there were three major ones. Two of them were very good about voluntarily putting a flag or a fraud alert, flagging your file, but there was one that was less receptive. That was part of the reason that Congress enacted those provisions of the Fair and Accurate Transactions Act, was to make sure that all citizens had the benefit of that sort of a service. But the FACT Act provisions are only triggered by the filing of an identity theft report. And that is defined as a report, the filing of which exposes the person to prosecution for perjury if the report contains false information. Now, what that generally means is a police report. So I think Chair Brown or Representative Gilman, someone asked, if you lost your wallet, could you just call and have a freeze placed on your report? Well, under FACT Act, no, not unless you had first filed a police report with a police agency or with some other government agency, the filing of which would expose you to perjury if there were any false information contained in that report. So that's how the FACT Act works. And it does now provide that same level of service to all citizens that was provided to Julie Brandis and her husband when their strategic investment firm, I assume, called and asked for that alert to be placed on it. So, I mean, it's not generally available to everyone. It's only available through federal law to victims of identity theft that have made reports. What this legislation before the committee now, and as I said, there's another one in the Senate, would do is that it would extend that ability to all citizens, regardless of whether or not they had yet been victims of identity theft, to help prevent them from becoming so. So I just wanted to make the state of that clear for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. From when the idea came up to when it became federal law, the FACT Act, how long did that take? And if you, I mean, in my opinion, if the federal government's going to do this, we should just let them do it and not carve us out or all that stuff. And I know people want things now. I want a lot of stuff now, too. But do you, how long did that FACT Act get to go through from its conception to finalization? And then how do you think the federal government is going in this direction? How long will it take?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schauffler, I think that the FACT Act, I know that there were some, it was under discussion, I want to say in 2003, because ironically there were two bills that were passed in the 2003 session that were later preempted by the FACT Act because it covered the same area, and that's the sort of preemption that is affected by FACT Act, that it preempts state laws that govern the exact same area as FACT does. So I would say that may have been under discussion maybe in 2002, was passed in 2003, went into effect in December of 2003. Is that right? So it's been in effect, but I thought maybe the industry would know. So it's been in effect for maybe a year or so now. It's still all relatively new. In fact, the Federal Trade Commission was required to adopt rules to enact more than 40 different provisions of FACT Act, and they're still engaged in rulemaking now, so it's still a work in process. Second part, is the federal government likely to act? I know in the wake of the security breach of B of A that affected many federal employees that there are now hearings ongoing before Congress. Hard to say, but it's certainly something that is of personal interest to many members of Congress at this point. I wouldn't be surprised if there might not be bills introduced to address some parts of what some of these bills introduced before you may address, but I don't know.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2412. And
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that Representative Ackerman's letter was entered into the record and you have a copy of it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Janet. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3097. Tell us again what the bill does, and Mark Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3097 is a bill that was heard at the Friday meeting in Portland at the NECA IBEW Training Center. It eliminates the sunset on DCBS's authority to study and implement a program for electronic access to building codes information. It replaces the authority they have now for a limited area pilot program with authority for a permanent statewide program. The program has been in the Tri-County area, and it also allows resources that are currently dedicated to the department's Tri-County Building Industry Service Center to be used for building code enforcement, for making consistency of building code enforcement statewide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Mark, you're a day early with that tie, aren't you?
Yes.
Isn't that tomorrow?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Some would argue you're many days late with that tie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Long, you know, in the government we're used to being late, so I thought I'd try to get a jump start on it. I just have a few comments on the bill. I know we had the hearing last week. Although Representative Kitts did ask me to spend about a half hour kind of discussing the nuances of our IT system and going into great...
here that believes that.
Going into great detail on what we're doing. But no, seriously, we are supportive of this bill. It supports our ongoing efforts to promote regulatory streamlining, consistency, and compliance. Just a couple things. You know, this bill is going to help us make the permitting system process work smoother. It's going to help on consistency issues by standardizing some of the permit types. And one of the other components that it does is I think it's going to help businesses comply with the law better, because right now you have contractors who, you know, may be doing work on a weekend that they thought was repair require work, and then all of a sudden it needs to be permitted work, and now they can go in, get their permit on the weekend, they're legal, don't have to worry about trying to hide or try to make those business decisions when they're unable to get those permits. So we think the bill helps us continue the good work that we've done during the interim, and we appreciate your support. And with that, I'll unless you would like that extended version, I'll conclude my comments.
Janet reminded me to ask you if there's any physical impact by this might have the potential of expanding and growing the program.
Mr. Chair, no. The bill's permissive, and so it allows us to, I believe it says, I need to open it up just to double check. It's been almost 3 or 4 days since I've looked at it. But the bill's permissive and allows us to continue the program that we already have in place and allow local governments to tap into it if they want. Now, as far as an overall impact, I must let you know that jurisdictions who choose to work into our system will have to decide whether they want to spend the time and energy to work with us to tap into our electronic system. So there may be some impact on local government, but that's something that they do when they choose to. It doesn't mandate it, and we've already had 6 jurisdictions want to be part of the pilot and are spending time and resources with us to do this, and we expect, with the passage of this bill, additional jurisdictions, not only in the metro area, but on a statewide basis. I've already received contact from folks in the Mid-Willamette Valley, and as I mentioned earlier, I hope to get some folks down in the Jackson-Josephine County area because of some issues that we're aware of down there. So,
thank you, Mark. Any other questions? Don't see none. Thank you again.
You bet. Am I done representing?
Great job.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3097 and open the work session on House Bill 3097. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move Bill 3097 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3097 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Excuse.
Representative Hugh.
Excuse.
Chairman.
Aye. Motion carries. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill. Oh, need a carrier, right. Representative Kitts will carry for me. Thank you. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2007. Janet, again, please tell us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2007 was introduced by this committee earlier this month. It would authorize the Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish pilot projects for consolidation of state licenses. It allows state agencies that participate in the pilots to use combined applications, adopt common license terms, to charge adjusted fees, and to issue combined licenses. It requires DCBS to prepare a proposal for combined licenses for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the Department of Agriculture, and provides that state agencies that participate in the pilot on a voluntary basis. The provisions would sunset on June 30th, 2008. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Pat Allen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Pat Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining provided you just a brief written summary that actually doesn't add too much more than what Janet did in terms of the section by section. You'll recall at the beginning of the session I mentioned the circumstance of small retailers, convenience stores, that are regulated by a large number of different agencies, and that we were in the midst of doing a pilot project to try to deal with how to simplify some of their licensing requirements as a part of that system of regulation they deal with. This bill authorizes us to take the next step in that pilot, which is taking a group of these businesses and working on a combined license for our combined license process for them. It would also let us work during the next interim on other similar kinds of projects. The idea being able to bring you back the fruits of what we learned from those pilots in the 07 session. We've been working on this particular pilot with the Neighborhood Grocery Association, who've been helping us with reaching out to stakeholders. Not aware of concerns about this bill particularly, and I'd be happy to answer questions you might have.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, one brief question, and Pat, I apologize that I didn't ask you this when we met, but it just came to my mind. At what point will we reevaluate the effectiveness of the pilot project and determine whether or not it's good to go forward, delete it, extend it? What are the provisions that are in place at this point?
Sure.
I don't recall reading them in the bill.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill sunsets in June of 2008, and so what we would basically need to do is whatever we do with pilots from now through the next legislative session, to make any of it stick, we'd need to come back to the next session and actually make permanent changes in licensing. The June 2008 date lets us unwind things if either we decide they don't make sense or we bring it to you and you decide it doesn't make sense.
Gotcha. Thank you for your clarification.
Any other questions? I don't see any more. Pat, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. This is a good bill should pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I agree.
I've heard that before.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2007, and there's one other issue with it I want to bring back later, so we'll put off working it today. And Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the rules be suspended and allow Representative Schaffler to vote on House Bill 3097.
Representative Kitts moves the rules be suspended to allow Representative Schaffler vote on House Bill 3097. Is there any objection? They're suspended. Representative Schaffler, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler votes aye on House Bill 3097. Janet, anything else?
Mr. Chair, we're 9 o'clock on Friday. We did talk about potentially having an evening meeting the week of would be March 30th, which would be a Wednesday evening. And there's still some property there, but you might want to check schedules. And you were going to check whether they wanted to do more of a 5-7 kind of meeting or a 7-9.
What kind of poison do you want to take? 5-6, 7?
8:30.
I'd rather go 5-7 and get it done.
4-6.
I have to eat though because I'm a diabetic. So
you can eat in the committee. There's no rule stating that you can't eat in committee, as Representative Holby's doing right now.
He lives here at the committee, Mr. Chair.
Well, Holby,
I heard there was coffee cake.
Holby say something, but right now his mouth's full.
So it's earlier.
Earlier,
probably as we possibly can.
Food provided.
Okay. We'll make it earlier.
I didn't prefer 4-6. I think Representative Schaffler would too.
Well, I want people to eat. I don't want people's health suffering.
You know, I think today I felt like we opened Pandora's box and we started talking about identity theft.
Yeah,
this is a huge issue.
It is huge.
And this one bill is not going to, by any means, get its hands around it one way or another. And I don't know whether there's other legislation here pending that's looking at the issue. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the committee's indulgence. I realize that I had several questions. This issue is huge in my district, as I know it is in other people's district, but it is centered in Hillsborough in Washington County. I mean, it is a huge, huge issue. I mean, every instance that the chair mentioned was related to my district. And so I appreciate and apologize for the lengthy questioning, but I do want to make sure that we get at the problem. Also, I'd like to get a pulse of the committee. I'd like to buy coffee for the next meeting. If I know this is a coffee-drinking committee. Would that be acceptable with everybody here?
Starbucks is fine with me.
I think it's going to be Cafe today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'll support my colleague.
Is this a morning meeting or no?
We're at 9 o'clock Friday, or thereabouts. All right. And with that, we're adjourned.
Oh.